Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
What's good, internet? It is Monday, July 16th, and you are listening to Waypoint Radio episode 170. That's a lot of them. Line them up,
so
one
many.
After the next, and you just wind up with a lot of episodes. I'm your host, Austin Walker. Joining me today, that was the voice of Danielle Riendo calling in from Brooklyn.
Okay.
Wow. Captain Toadette herself, Danielle Riendo.
Hi.
Live on the line. Also joining me, Patrick Klepek, holding a cup of tea, of coffee?
Tea. Okay.
You're just coffee. You have it very close to you.
I'm trying to get some of its energy before I put it into my mouth. It's a Dharma.
Mm-hmm.
It's the Swan Station from Lost.
There you go.
Nice.
Also joining us, asking the real questions like, Patrick, what's that logo? Rob Zachney.
Nutritious, crisp, clean water over here.
That's nice.
Good health, clean living.
That's good.
I got the water, too.
Yeah,
I got 32 ounces of water sitting to my left, Rob. I can multitask.
32 ounces is very specific.
That's a specific because that's amount.
That's all that, it's got a marker that says 32 ounces, and I fill it to the top.
To there, to the 32-ounce mark. Good. How's everybody doing today? It's Monday. It doesn't feel like Monday to me for some reason. It feels like a different day. Like, not like a Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, or Sunday. Like, a unique eighth day.
Like that seems like a good Monday. If it doesn't feel like a Monday, that seems like a pretty good outcome.
I guess that's true. It's hot. I'm working from home. And so it feels like it could be... It feels like the first day back from a holiday, even though we didn't have a holiday, we just had a weekend. That's what it feels like for me. And maybe that's a good sign. Maybe that means I got some good stuff done over the weekend. I got some recuperation in. I got some resting in. I played some video games. How about y'all? Were your weekends good? No, Danielle's shaking her head. Fair.
Yeah, that's to be honest, that's understandable. Jury duty as well is a hell of a thing to discover you got coming up.
Wait, do you have jury duty coming up? Who is jury duty coming up? Danielle, what's happening?
I got the jury duty notice as I was like saying goodbye to one of my pets who moved out this week.
How?
So
how was the timing on this? The way it is.
I did something to piss off God. That is all I could think of. God is mad. God is very angry at me. Don't know why.
But now you can take it out on someone else through the criminal justice system. I don't advocate it, but you're on a grand jury. So really, like, that case is moving forward either way.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'm so glad.
Yeah.
I'm so happy.
And I know your values being what they are, you're probably going to be like, hell yeah, let me join Team Prosecutor.
Oh, yeah. You know
those guys are always on the up and up.
You know me. Yeah.
Well, it depends on the case these days, you know? Maybe there are some indictments and some cases you would like to be involved with.
It's true. I'm definitely on the piss tape case. That's
wow.
My case.
Finally, yeah. We know. We have an insider. Yep.
That's what 2018 would turn right the fuck around, is Danielle Riendo is like a juror on the P tape case.
Please.
I'll write a book for you.
Like
We'll do a podcast on it.
The future of the administration hinges on Danielle. That would be nice. That would be like sending Hans Gruber to his death.
Listen, I had a manager training last week, and they were very clear that we offer jury duty leave. But I just want you to know, if you get the P tape case, I'm not even acting as a manager. I'm just acting as a friend. You go spend all the time you need on that that P case.
Can't wait.
That's all you.
Can't wait, really?
Yeah. Uh huh. Yep. God, we can't even talk about politics today because I, today was the day that Trump and Putin stood on a stage and Trump said out loud that he trusted Putin's word more than the intelligence agencies of America. And listen, I got some issues with the intelligence agencies of America, but I'm also not the president of the United States. And just, god damn, is this where it's at? And yes, it is.
I think that's part of the reason that it feels like later in the week. This doesn't usually, yes. I don't usually wake up in the morning and it's just fucking a shit turd in my mouth of news. And then it just doesn't stop. It's just been me desperately trying to tab away to anything else all day and being like, well, it's been 45 seconds. Probably time to tab back over and see what other shit show has occurred today. So you know. It's partially to the weirdness of this Monday is because it feels more, at least this is Tuesday, right? But it's not.
So between the ongoing Amazon transnational worker strike in Europe that we are standing in solidarity with, no streaming today. I think my whole day is on a Thursday time cycle. Like I'm already ready for tomorrow's Friday afternoon surprises to start hitting. But it's not going to be Friday tomorrow. It's going to be Tuesday. So, I don't know. In any case, what I did this weekend is play a video game. I've been playing a JRPG.
Oh.
It's a Japanese role-playing game. Which, I know, just to clarify, those are often RPGs made in Japan, but there's also a connotation of it being a certain style of RPG. I probably don't need to explain what a JRPG is to this audience.
It's a Final Fantasy.
I think this is more of a saga than a Final Fantasy. But yes, it's a Final Fantasy. This is a Square
Enix. Which Final Fantasy is saga?
Okay, it's fine. Final Fantasy Legend, actually, is the actual right answer.
Wow, okay, there you go. That's a good, because that game was actually a saga game brought over here as Final Fantasy Legend,
yes,
right?
It was
a Game Boy game.
That's actually correct.
Oh, okay.
Final Fantasy Legend's really cool. I don't know that it's good, but it's really cool.
It was different. It was like it was one of those like Zelda 2 situations.
Yes.
Where nice, all right.
It found its champions like partially ironically and then like partially because it was interesting and different.
Yes. It was super weird. There's lots of like consumable stuff in that game. It's been a long time since I played it, but I played the hell out of it on an emulator when I was in high school or maybe right before high school. I don't remember, but I was playing lots of Game Boy games on emulators between the ages of like 12 and 18. So,
I mean, you know, like everyone goes through a phase.
Yes. Yes. We're all on, you know, Emu Paradise or whatever you want to call it. Emu Paradise. Yeah. Whatever.
Emu. Emu.
Emu Paradise.
Emu Paradise.
Oh, I love to load up my emulators and play.
I like it as emu because then you think like, oh, it's like an emu, like a bird.
Yeah.
And that way when my mom comes over and she's like, what are you doing? What are you downloading? Those better not be illegal stolen video game ROMs. I'm like, no, this is a
Rams.
These are about emus and rams. This isn't ROMs.
Right,
this is about the
it's
birds.
Animals.
It's an animal website. Exactly.
Yeah, nice.
anyway, I've been playing Octopath Traveler, the hit.
It's another animal, right?
It is.
It's an octopus.
Oh, no, right, an octopus traveler. Yes. What do I see on Twitter? Octopus Blues Traveler. Exactly. it is. I'm surprised by how much, maybe this just reflects the people I follow on Twitter, but I follow a lot of people. A lot of people are playing this game right now, more than I expected to be, and maybe it's the nostalgia factor that's brought in some people. I suspect that's probably even why I got pulled into it a little bit. So it is the new Square Enix and Acquire developed JRPG that's on Switch.
They did that last one that was an old school throwback game.
So they did this team did the
Tales of Setsuna or something.
No, that's right? A different team. That's a different team.
Oh, is it?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
These people did the Bravely Default games, which
those games
were
actually pretty good.
They are pretty good. They were 3DS JRPGs that were also Final Fantasy adjacent.
Had like a unique combat system that was like built around like point trying to acquire points and you were spending those points and
you got like brave points that you could then spend to like take multiple turns per turn
you
or
could
something
basically sit out a turn Right. And that would give you an extra turn the next time.
Yes, so exactly.
You could, like, bulk up. You could kind of, like, stack up turns. Yes. And it was really a fun combat
system. So this system is like that, but a little streamlined, actually. You can really see that they took some of those core ideas. Really quickly, the high level of it, and I'll get into the combat a little bit, because I do think it's fascinating. The high level is that there are 8 characters you can pick from. They all spell out the word Octopath, if you list them all. So it's like Ophelia, Cyrus, Ulbrich, what's the T? Trissa, Ulbrich, and then 4 other ones. Those are the 4 that I have. Oh, Primrose. I have Octopa right now. And I have not gotten the ATH of Octopath. And each one's a different class, right? So, you know, I started with Cyrus, who is a scholar, which means that he has, like, some magic skills, and can, everybody in this game has, like, combat skills. They have passive skills, which are things that just give them bonuses. So one of Cyrus' early ones is like, yo, let's be careful when we walk around so we don't get into fights. What if we didn't get into a lot of fights? And so he just has a cool passive that lets you, like, lower the random encounter rate. And then you also have what are called path actions, and each character has their own path action, which is a thing you can use with any NPC you can talk to. So, for instance, I have this guy named Ulbrich, who is a knight. He was a knight to a lord. Every character has their own story. It opens with whatever characters you start story, and then whenever you encounter one of the other main characters in the game, you do a flashback and play through their whole story. Their whole, like, not their whole story, but their whole intro kind of story. Ulbrich is a knight who, you know, he was loyal to the king. The king was betrayed, and he was left for dead. You know, he's just a good fighter. He can tank for the group, etc. But his path action is just challenge anyone you can talk to a duel, and then you fight them. And if you win, you get XP and loot. And so you can use that in the world sometimes to solve puzzle or like to solve side quests. Or to, like, open up pathways to where there'll be, like, someone in front of a door that has a treasure chest behind the door. And so you could use Ophelia, who is this cleric, to be like, hey, join my team, you know, as a summon, basically. And she can convince someone to, like, join your crew for a limited period of time. Or you could have Ulbrich go and be like, yo, we're fighting now. And then knock him the fuck out and then walk in the door and take the loot that's inside. There are a lot of interesting little things in terms of the side quests, in terms of the art. It's a really gorgeous looking game. I think it's either, sometimes it's really pretty, and other times it's just someone turned all the sliders all the way up on all of their graphical effects. Like, I don't know if the 3 of you have seen this game or not. Please just do a search for Octopath Traveler and look at a video, look at a trailer.
It kind of feels like they just put a bunch of, like, Photoshop filters on sometimes. And it's 100%. Like, oh, if we just overwhelm you with things on the screen, sometimes that is mistaken for something pretty.
Right.
Like, and it seems more just noisy and messy. And I saw some that the game sometimes would actually benefit from just being able to, like, yo, could I just, like, turn off, like, half of these? Because, like, the pixel art is really, really well done.
Yes.
And, like, the contrast between the 2D and 3D is really, really well done.
Yes.
And all the other stuff feels like what I used to do when I got access to, like, Photoshop or PaintShop Pro when
100%.
I was 16. And it was just like, yo, I'm just going to put all this fucking shit all, or I get Instagram for the first time. It's like, filters, filters, filters. You go back and look at those photos you posted on Instagram when Instagram started. Those photos are garbage. Mm-hmm. Like, they look disgusting now, because you had no self-control. And it feels like sometimes Octopath Traveler has, like, didn't show enough restraint in the way they try to dress up the 2D stuff, when on its own, I think they could have gone, like, half as far as they did, and it still would have achieved the effect they were going for.
There are times that it totally works for me. One of the characters you get is a merchant, Trissa, and she lives in, like, a little Mediterranean seaside town. And the way the water looks and the way some of the, like, the trees blow in the wind, all works really well. And the kind of over, like, it's completely overexposed, to the point where, like, everybody's face just looks blown the fuck out anywhere that isn't inside of a cave. But on this, like, sun, you know, swept Mediterranean village, it totally works. But there are other times when it's just like, I can't see what you're supposed to be showing me. But all said, I like the effect. I like the overall presentation enough that I'm still being wowed every once in a while. I climb a mountain and see a cathedral in the distance or whatever and go like, holy shit, that looks good. Or in combat, I actually think it looks very good. I really love the enemy sprites a lot. I really like all of the kind of kinetic animation around attacks and stuff like that. It does a good job of making you feel like there's good impact, sort of like Darkest Dungeon or something. So you have all these characters, and then when you get into fights, the thing that it does that's like Bravely Default is that there is a similar system of what's called BP, which I think are just battle points. I mean, I guess they could still be brave
it's
points.
British Petroleum
points, right? Exactly. Yep, okay. Your BP points. And the way it works is every turn you can do an attack, you can do a defense, you can use an item, or you can use a class ability, which is everything from casting spells to, like, doing AoE attacks with your big sword, or like a special, you know, spear attack, or a buff. If you have like the dancer class, she can dance in a way that gives your party magical, you know, buffs or debuffs the enemy or whatever, right? And you can do any of those any turn. And then any turn, you can also spend one of these BP to get an increased effect. And with a regular attack, that just means you attack twice instead of once. And with any of the, like, spells, it's like you get a better effect. So, like, if you do the dance with the dancer, that gives you extra damage for two turns. It gives you, like, you know, plus physical attack for two turns. When you use one of the BP with it, it goes up to four turns or five turns. And so that's already pretty interesting. And then it gets really interesting when you take into account the fact that every enemy has between two and five or six vulnerabilities. Every enemy also has these shield points where you are doing okay damage to enemies, and you're just kind of going back and forth like all JRPGs, like most JRPGs, I guess. One attack, then they attack. You know, one of you attacks, then one of them attacks. But if you can destroy their shield points, and you do that by hitting their vulnerabilities, they miss a turn and take more damage from everything. And so it feels sort of like an evolution of the Bravely Default system, and it's sort of like an evolution of the Persona 3, 4, and 5 system, where what you're looking for is, what is this enemy vulnerable to, and how do I hit it with the vulnerability enough times to interrupt whatever its upcoming attacks are, and then really double down. And so you're like balancing how many BP, because you want to have a lot of BP once you knock down their shields so that you can really hit them hard. Or you can spend your BP to try to knock down their shields quickly by hitting them with their weak with a bunch of times in a row. It ends up being just a really satisfying combat system where I'm 10 hours in and really enjoying all of the random encounters still. Like, I'm still, there's almost something like a puzzle-like quality to it, where it's like, okay, if I can hit this weird dung beetle that's pushing a skull with a lightning attack, then that'll knock its shield down, and then I can switch over to this rat man with a spear in his mouth and hit him with, I'll spend 2 BP to use the dagger skill that my dancer has to knock him down, and then I'll clean up with like a supercharged lightning attack from my mage. And that stuff just, it feels good, and I've been enjoying that so far. The stories are really not hit or miss, but like,
yeah, that's, I've heard really mixed things about the storytelling in this game, and that, like, especially you would think the way this game is presented, Octopath Traveler, 8 paths.
Yep.
It'll all come together, or there'll be like a thing at the end. And apparently this game has none of that. It's so just like 8 stories that just kind of just flutter out at the end in a really strange way.
There's two things there. One is
because you're rotating between them, right? Like, you will hit a wall and then have to go to another character, right? Like,
so you can't just go all the way through. Yes, you can't just be like, okay, I'm going to see Cyrus the Scholar's story all the way through. Like, right. I did my first act with him, and the next act I need to be like level 23 with him, and I've been raising that level by going off and doing everybody else's act one story. So you're just like, the comparison I can make is, I've been in D&D games that feel like this, where you're like, okay, today we're going to focus on Rob's character's like personal story, and the whole session is about Rob's character's personal story. And then we're all just like, oh yeah, I guess I'm going to hang out because I like Rob. I'm in the party. And in real life, I would probably have Rob just let Rob go deal with this by himself. I probably shouldn't be here while he's confronting his arch nemesis from when he was in the army 20 years ago. But I don't know, ride or die, I guess. And so in this, there definitely are moments where it's like, in the cutscenes, the rest of your crew doesn't show up. It's just whatever character is the cutscene character. So there's a thing early on where it's like, I'm going to sneak into the ancient cave of our lost god and retrieve the final embers so I can continue the old tradition and light all of the lanterns throughout the land. But I have to be very careful. And it's like you and 3 other people just like stomping past the guards. And like, okay, I guess that's just ignore that I'm here with them. Or, you know, characters who are like, you know, an enemy will be like, I got you all alone now, or like you're outnumbered. Like, no, you're super not outnumbered. I have three other people with me. Two of them also have summons that have summoned two other people with them. I have six people. You have four people. I outnumber you. And so it can get weird where it's just, there's lots of dissonance in terms of what you know is happening in the mechanics versus what's supposed to be happening in the story. Right. But I'm kind of fine with hand waving most of that. What I wish there was more of is you occasionally will get these little vignettes where your characters will talk to each other, but they're not talking to each other ever. Like, you don't ever, like, beyond that, you're not just like doing a side quest and your knight is like, I'll challenge this person, and then your scholar is like, hey, now Ulbrich, please be calm, we don't have to fight everyone we see. Like, there's none of that like Bioware style bickering or banter, and that is a not a bummer, because I knew it going in, but I know that I would like that version of the game more. But two, there is something at the end of this game from what I've read. A lot of reviewers didn't do the side quests necessary to see the end game. And I'm not throwing reviewers under the bus.
Well, that sounds like a shitty way to design your game.
it's side content. It's a side thing that's like, yep, you can finish all the, you can finish all of their personal stories. Like,
if the way is like, if you finish the game on like, let's say, normal main path.
Right.
None of it comes together.
Well, so no, it's
but,
not,
oh, if you do all the side stuff, then maybe you unlock
it. Like, the thing is, there isn't a main path. There are eight main paths, and each of those come to a conclusion, because those are all individual things.
Octopath.
Right. And one of the things one of the things I genuinely like a lot about this game is that it is not shoving any ancient prophecy down my fucking throat. Like,
right.
Every character, there are characters who have stuff that, like, I can see what they're teasing already to some degree. Like, Cyrus, the scholar's quest is about trying to find this lost book that's, like, been gone for 20 years and is about, you know, summoning a demon from hell or whatever, right? And the cleric stuff is about the god who helped trap a demon in hell thousands of years ago or whatever. But, like, other characters are just like, oh, I'm here to get revenge on the trio of people who killed my family, or, you know, killed my dad, or like, oh, I'm a merchant and I just want to go see the world before I settle into my family's shop and like run my family shop. And a lot of the stuff that really works for me in this game are these little quiet moments, or like the small scale of stakes where it's just about personal beef. And I'm glad that it doesn't, I don't know, maybe 30 hours asking me this, but like, for now, I'm happy to have whatever that other thing is be a side quest that I can pull the tail on, and like, oh wow, there's actually more and more and more here than it being the focus of any of their particular stories. But I don't know, like, I didn't need this to be Final Fantasy VI, you know what I mean, where you do have all of those different characters and their stories do kind of conclude together. I think I'm pretty enamored by the unique take this is going for. We'll see again if it continues that way.
I am glad it's on Switch, though, because like, the reason I stuttered out on Persona 5, a game like the 15 or 20 hours I did play, I liked a lot, but it's just like the parts of JRPGs that like are really irritating for like my life at this point. Like, I just did, like, when I was going to sit down and play a game, like, I got 2 hours. It's like, there are so many times in JRPGs where it's like, this 2 hours is not going to accomplish anything meaningful. Yes. Like, I am just like, because I need to do the 2 hours to set up the other 2 hours to do the thing. And because my time is so limited, for like sitting down in front of a TV time, right?
Yes.
Like, that's why I'm excited for Octopath, because like, I understand why some of that stuff exists in those games. And for some people, that is an appealing part of those games, that like the, like, grind when done well, like, is, it can be an escape in its own right. And I understand like the appeal of that, the calming part of that. But, the Switch fit, like, I can find like 45 minutes to like, okay, squirrel away, like, my daughter's watching a movie or she's taking a nap or she's painting or whatever, and like, I can do those parts of the game and find the enjoyment in it, but that's not what I'm looking for when I'm sitting down in front of my projector to play a game, like, before I get too tired and have to go to sleep. And so Octopath on a PS4 would be like deeply, deeply unappealing.
Yes.
But Octopath on a Switch is like, oh, right, like, those parts of the game, like, I can find like that 10, 15 minutes to like sit and just grind through some battles. And like, so I'm like, this is a long way of saying, like, I just wish they put Persona 5 on the Switch so I could actually play that game.
Yeah.
But in the meantime, like, I'm excited for Octopath to be on a device that will allow me to engage with a genre that, like, I largely find off-putting because that's just not what I'm looking for totally. Out of my time with games usually.
We will. There's a question in today's question bucket that's kind of about that, so we'll wrap back around to that for sure. It's not the only game out on Switch this week. Really quick, I do want to, because I just finished the section, and I just want to say the one bummer I've had so far is there's a character who I like named Primrose, who is your dancer, who is as a combat character, she's all about buffs and debuffs. I've said that before, but her narrative, her intro, one, is frustrating because it has one of the best hooks, which is her dad was killed by three men with crow tattoos, and she, Assassin's Creed style, is going to fucking find them and kill them. And so she sets herself up as a dancer at a tavern where she believes that one of them has been spotted before. And is also a sex worker, right? This is the character who is a sex worker. The language is not unclear about that. But the way her intro arc ends, fridges another woman in a way that's, meant to be really emotionally impactful, but you've never really spent time with this other character. There is definitely, no going into Primrose's story that there will be some words thrown at her, not just in terms of calling her a whore, as the villain in that, first arc goes, but, some very specific... I didn't expect... There's one exchange specifically that I just did not expect from a Square Enix game, in which the man who is effectively her pimp is basically makes her an offer to come back into his good graces in a way that's just gross. I'm not saying it's off the table as a way of language that should be in a JRPG or anything like that, but it was it felt so out of nowhere because nowhere else in this game has that tone.
Right.
And part of her story works because her stuff feels darker and more real in some way. It feels like there are more particular stakes than are in the merchant girl who fights off the pirates and saves all the loot that they'd stolen from her family, and now she's off to see the world. Her adventure seems so lighthearted compared to the woman who goes into sex work in order to track down the killers of her father. And I'll say, in general, it isn't, demeaning towards sex work, but there is this just, one exchange just, struck me as being very... not lazy, but it felt like a very quick shorthand for let's really fucking hate this guy you're gonna go kill, in a way that just didn't leave me feeling great. But I'm excited to see more from that character. I mean, in fact, maybe that's the part of the thing is I wish there were more side things and more cross party things, because I want that character and the cool merchant lady to talk to each other and be like, one of them is bubbly and one of them knows what the world is, and I want those exchanges to happen, and I don't know that it's going to happen in the way I want.
That's one of those instances where I wish... I'd be curious if someone did a comparison of the original Japanese text and the localization. It's just a hunch, but I wonder if that's maybe a case of the localization trying to do some heavy lifting that the original text...
Was vaguer on or something.
Yeah, totally. I don't know. I'm pulling that out of my ass, but that is that my reporting on previous localizations and differences between Western and Japanese values, and I'm curious if there's anything to that. I have no idea, but it's the way it's stuck out to you makes me wonder if someone did a look at both of those, if they would find anything interesting.
Totally. So that's Octopath. I'm gonna stick with it at least for this week and see if at the end of the week if I'm still feeling it. It does fit
into
my
knife. I'm gonna play it too. I'm super curious.
It fits into my knife very easily. I've been playing too much Octopath Traveler. Anyway,
Switch knife.
It is not the only Switch game that came out last week though. I know a game starring a little toad has returned to us.
Do you know what time it is?
No, what time? Wait,
time
what time?
Time for adventure! That's what time it is.
That's Toad is on the line. We have Toad here. Captain Toad. How's it going?
Okay!
I was going to ask how it was going, but I guess it's going okay.
Does this game
take place in Providence?
Okay! Your mama! Yeah, I'll stop that now. I'm playing Captain Toad.
This week on Crime Town.
God, I fucking
okay. Yeah,
Toad would fit right in, actually. Yeah. To be quite honest with you, Toad fit right the fuck in Providence, Rhode Island. Nobody would bat an eye. I feel like I knew people who talked like that, actually. But yeah, I'm playing Captain Toad Treasure Tracker, which just came out on the Switch. It's one of the finest Wii U games, along with Donkey Kong Country Tropical Freeze, which also came out on the Switch in the last few months. That came out in May, and this is obviously July, so yeah, it's been a couple months since we had a 2014, one of the best games of 2014 come back out on the Switch.
I back that 100%. Captain Toad is an all-time great puzzle game. Like, not just good for the Wii U, all-time great puzzle game.
It's fantastic.
It is exactly the sort of game that I actually would like a lot and need to find the time to play.
It's a platformer with no jumping.
Yes,
it's like a
really
good puzzle platformer with no jumping. Everything you're doing is traversal, sort of walking around. Captain Toad walks pretty slowly and manipulating the camera so that you find the right optimal sort of paths through these very cool 3D levels. They're very much like little, they called them, I remember actually, back when I was at Polygon, I had an interview for Captain Toad when they were sort of showing it off with some of the designers, and they called it a garden in a box. That's their sort of design philosophy for these puzzles.
I love you, Nintendo.
It's really lovely and evocative. Yeah, it's very Nintendo. It's very,
very open
very
air.
Much.
You can see a direct line from Captain Toad to the experiments in Super Mario Odyssey.
Yes.
Which is a very expansive version of Captain Toad in a lot of ways.
This looks sensational.
Yeah, absolutely.
Oh, yeah.
It's the first lack of a toad, though.
Wait, what do you mean the lack of a... Oh, right. Toad is the name of this mushroom person.
Yes.
Rob.
It's been a while since I've had a Nintendo platform in my life.
Oh, you were looking for the frog adjacent Toad.
Literally for this last week, I've been like... Okay, so it's probably some sort of Frog and Toad are Friends inspired thing.
You're like a Mr. Toad style.
Yeah,
adventure.
And Captain Toad, I pictured him as being one of those old British army officers that still goes by his title even though he hasn't been with the regiment in 30 years.
Right, no, that's the character from Crime Town. That's him.
That's him, but with a Rhode Island accent as well.
He moved to Providence.
Sorry, but
I will say it's a wild ride, so that's appropriate, basically for what's going on here. yeah, thanks. For that one. Moment of silence for my joke that died. Anyway, it's a really, really great game. Obviously, there's not a ton new here. There are a few new things. I'm only a couple hours in. I'm probably going to put several more hours into it. But there are a few extra things. There's something like a little pixel toad mode, so you can actually go into puzzles you've already solved and sort of scour it for these tiny little pixel toads that are very much sort of from Mario Odyssey. There was remember the 2D sections of Mario Odyssey? Okay, so it's a lot like that. You're looking for a tiny little pixel toad, so you're basically rotating the camera all over the place to just kind of look and find, which is actually fun. I enjoy that kind of thing because I really like looking at these kinds of levels and sort of puzzling out how they were designed and all that other good stuff. It's also just a fantastic game that has a lot going on mechanically, even though your operations are very similar. You're just kind of walking around. That's the only way you're interacting necessarily with the world, other than spinning around the camera. But there's a lot of interesting things going on. There are sort of little touch things going on. There are things like moving panels in a certain sort of sequence so that you can drop down a particular way to get the sort of extra. There's little gems. There's three hidden gems in each level, as well as the sort of star.
Oh, they're so fun to find.
So
if
good.
I've pushed this line with Nintendo games since around Nintendo or Super Mario 3D Land, in which I think Nintendo hides some of its most clever designs behind collectibles in a way that is not as exploitative of people's time as lots of other games use collectibles. And I think there is no better example of that than Captain Toad. Captain Toad is probably the last game I can think of where I did everything. I found everything top to bottom. The only thing I couldn't finish was the last sort of challenge room thing where you have to survive for 10 minutes. There was something that I just couldn't quite get over the hump on, but I found everything in that game, and it was deeply satisfying because it wasn't just about collecting it. The comparison I would make was playing through any of the Uncharted games, there's all these little doodads and artifacts you can find along the way. But it's not. I never found it satisfying. It felt like you were just checkboxing. It was just there's 100 things to get, so I don't know, go load up a YouTube walkthrough where it's walk over here, go collect the thing. It's purely for the trophy. I didn't find that they were necessarily a reward for really understanding the environment. And in Captain Toad, especially because the areas are so small, it allows you to compartmentalize, like, oh, this is actually a task that I can do because this area is so tiny. It has to be here. And so when you do find it, there is such a deep satisfaction in the sort of, you know, unlocking some sort of, like, puzzle box sort of way. Like, aha, like, I put the camera at just this angle and the character at just this angle. And then, boom, like, I found this little piece of treasure. And, yeah, it is, I think, probably Nintendo's finest example of making collectibles like a rewarding form of game design as opposed to just padding the game itself.
From watching it again, I realized that one of the things that it recalls for me is the Go series of games that Eidos
put Square.
Out. Square. I was like, Square, but that's not right. Eidos, Square, put out around Hitman, Lara Croft, and DSX. Especially Lara Croft Go, which I think is the best of those. And if any of y'all have not played those games, Lara Croft Go is genuinely really great.
You can skip the Deus Ex one. It's fine, but the Hitman and the Lara Croft ones are both tremendous games.
I love those games, and it's like, oh, okay, yes, this is actually like a much more complex version of those in some ways. obviously, it's real time and not turn based, but I really want to play this. Mr. Toad's Wild Ride. I get it. It took me a second, Danielle. I got it just now. It's hot.
That was like 300 seconds, to be honest. I got it. I went to Disneyland a year and a half ago. Like, I got that reference.
I had just referenced Mr. Toad, but somehow I had forgotten the name of that story. That's on me.
That famous children's story, Mr. Toad.
I thought I was going to get a little reaction from that one. I was just definitely blanked. Like, hey. All right, fine. All right. Well, I'm really glad that you appreciated it.
So the new stuff there is, like you said, there's just the Pixel Toad, like, extra collectible.
It's sort of like it's an extra incentive to go back and scour these. Again, they're very little. They're very small, finite kind of puzzles. And I wouldn't say rooms because none of them are in a room. It's almost like a tiny 3D world that
it's like a diorama or something.
Often little squares, yeah, like diorama. Right. Again, the garden in a box kind of thing.
Yeah.
That you can just sort of twist around and look around. So it's another thing you can do in those worlds, especially right after you maybe beat it. So it's like, oh, and now there's another thing you can go and sort of look for. And it's satisfying if you find it satisfying to look through the world and get everything anyway, as Patrick was kind of saying. So, yeah.
You know what? Toad got a bad rap. You know, Toad didn't get to be the hero. Let Toad live. Let Toad be the winner. Let Toad be your hero. Let Toad
and
into
Toad
your
Ed
heart.
Is also a hero in this game.
Oh, awesome.
They sort of switch off being the hero, which is really cute.
Nice.
And there are bosses. That's the other thing that's interesting about this. There are sort of like action bosses that, again, you're always sort of a little slow. You're not you're not Mario.
You're not jumping on anyone's head. Right.
But you get your timing right, and you can sort of manipulate the environment in such a way that you best these bosses. So it's a really fun little challenge.
You know, don't forget, in Mario 2, Toad is the best one at pulling things out of the ground. You know, Toad's the best puller.
He's the best at pulling, and you do a lot of that in this game, actually. They call them pluck patches, and you throw little vegetables at Shy Guys. It's great.
Pluck patches is my favorite recurring Souls character. All right, we should take a quick break. When we come back, we'll hear from Rob and Patrick about stuff they've been playing and maybe take a couple of questions out of the old question bucket. We will be right back.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
All right, we are back for real now. Patrick, Rob, tell me, we wanted to start with Nintendo Switch things that had just come out. But do either of you have any video games you've been playing, whether recently released or not?
We haven't heard a lot from Rob. Rob?
Rob, tell me.
Us, what are you doing?
Transport
Rob,
me somewhere. I'm gonna close my eyes. I'm gonna feel the warmth and heat from the summer outside, the summer sun on my cheek. Teleport me somewhere. Bring me somewhere else.
All right. Well, as you sit there with your eyes closed,
yeah,
you feel the summer heat, but you notice it begins to dry, and grains of sand begin to flick across your face, and then the street noise outside fades to the low rumble of an approaching sand carrier.
A sand carrier?
Yes.
Like in Star Wars.
A bit, but more like an aircraft carrier rather than a big Volkswagen bus driving across the desert full of shit that you're trying to sell to gullible farmers.
All right, you're losing me a little bit. Aircraft carriers are really big. How am I supposed to do anything with an aircraft carrier?
Big enough.
The whole...
It's a hover aircraft carrier, but not like a helicarrier. It hovers a little bit. Well, some of them
do. Is Nick Fury here?
No. Instead, you've got a variety of factions who are fighting a battle over artifacts located out there in the desert that hold the secret to your people's past.
All right, I'm all the way in. You said all my favorite words, factions, artifacts,
yeah,
peoples, and you said peoples with an S on the end.
I did.
That's how I know it's for me.
Yeah, there are many cultures on this desert, but this is not your homeworld. This is not where your people are from. You are exiles here, and written into the souls of your people is the knowledge that one day you must leave this place. But why were you placed there? Why are you stuck here on this desert planet? And why do some people in your why do some of the cultures, within your race, why do some of the cultures get very antsy about the idea of uncovering the secrets? What are they guarding?
What are they? What secrets do they have?
Exactly.
And, does Guccifer work for them?
Or do they work for Guccifer? That's the real question. And that is one of the questions you'll have to answer in Homeworld Deserts of Karak, which is actually a prequel.
I just love this. Wow, this is the weirdest stage show I've ever been to at
E3. I love this.
And those are some of the questions you'll answer this year in Homeworld Deserts of Karak.
Too real. I've been in too many
demos
time, in that
actually.
Way.
So it's a prequel of the Homeworld games, and it's actually a very clever one. And this game's a couple years old, but I got back into it this weekend. I was playing Skirmish with some folks, and I'd forgotten just how it's like straight up one of the best RTS games of like the last 5 years.
This is one of those games that I didn't play. I wanted to play, but that has had such a pretty positive a response that always makes me... This is the style of game that makes me go, okay, wait, slow down whenever anybody says the RTS is dead. And that's a style of game that exists in every genre. It's like the style of game that exists where, like, someone will say the adventure game died between blank and blank. It's like, well, wait a second, what about this one thing that was really fucking good and that just didn't... What we mean is maybe it didn't find a big audience. It didn't have a huge impact the way that the genre used to. But from everything I've heard, and from even just a little tease you just gave me, Deserts of Karak sounds great.
Yeah, and it's evocative in that way. Like, there is a tremendous sense of place and physicality to just the way the units move over the sand. Like, watching these aircraft carriers, like, hurl themselves over, like, massive dunes and then, like, hit the backslope and start, like, churning downwards through the dune. It's, like, really incredible to watch. Like, you have the sense of the incredible, like, vastness of the desert and the scale of the units. And just, like, the narrative is really good. If you recall, the sort of the precipitating event of the original Homeworld games is, like, your people have just created, like, a generation ship to take to the stars and, like, go search for life, for a different planet to live on. And the minute that ship takes flight, aliens show up and basically say, like, you're breaking the agreement.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you were told never to do this. You've broken the agreement, therefore you know the consequences. Nobody knows the consequences, but it turns out they just glass the planet, basically.
Right.
And this takes place before all that, in sort of the moment where, your culture realizes that it could leave this planet. Like, it uncovered the secrets of how they got dumped there in the first place. And they could take to the stars again. But half the sort of nations in your culture are, like, aggressively against the idea of anyone investigating these wrecks. Because, like, they may not know the reason why they feel like they have to prevent anyone from uncovering any secrets, but the only thing they do know is that it's their job to prevent anyone from sort of regaining the stars. But as an RTS, it's so good. I can't talk too much about, like, the faction differences, but it's really, like, the matches play at a really decent clip. There are some very clear and pointed choices you have to make about the way you're going to sort of advance upwards through the tech tree. But one of the coolest features of this is your aircraft carrier. It is like your home base, and it has, like, you can unlock greater and greater, like, energy points you can dump into its systems. So, Austin, it's kind of like a battle mech.
It does seem like that. I'm looking at a video of it right now, and there are all these different things you can upgrade on this giant command center, like, mobile hovercraft super carrier. It looks cool.
Yeah, you can, like, put all the points into the guns and the armor and just turn it into, like, a giant battleship. Or you can basically park it somewhere strategic and, like, crank up its sensors and its repair beams, and, like, it becomes, like, a forward operating base, but, like, can't see combat.
Right.
And so you're sort of playing around with that stuff. And it's also got, like, maybe the best air unit management interface I've ever seen. Like, you basically have a little, like, interface panel that has all the fighters, bombers, and helicopters that are on your carrier. And you scramble them by unit type. Send them on different missions. And then with one button,
like,
you can return.
Micromanaging seven different fighters or whatever.
Right, you never have to hunt down your fighters, really. Like,
right,
you just...
Right. You're just like, hey, go bomb this thing, please.
Yeah, exactly.
And then it does that.
Yeah.
Cool.
I've been playing the hell out of that, and, like, it is still an absolute delight. And honestly, the campaign is great. The campaign especially will give you some, like, Battletech vibes. But...
Ancient technology that's, like, you can't just rebuild it because it's old.
Yeah, and the art style and presentation, like, just a lot of the sense of, like, just some really gorgeous, slightly animated, splash art and such.
Like, more than a motion comic, but not
fully
rendered animation, right?
Right. But then also both the art and just the way the missions are constructed, it's one of those games that does give you, like, you know, in Battletech, there's a sequence where you go to, like, a long lost, like, storehouse.
Yes, I super do.
Yeah.
It's great.
This game is full of moments like that,
cool,
where, like, you feel the dead hand of the past, like, reaching across the eons to touch you. It's amazing. So I highly recommend it. And, like, I don't know if there's much community around it, but, like, you find a couple people to play with. It's still just an absolute blast as an RTS.
Awesome. I'm glad that you've dug this one out from the past. It's I'd forgotten about this game. And it seems dope.
Yeah, I think it's a good summer jam for you, Austin.
Oh yeah, I need more
for all
more
that free time.
List. Yeah. Patrick, how about you? You got anything new bopping over there?
It's all Hollow Knight all the time. All
right.
I'll say this. I'll be short about it. I could probably talk about Hollow Knight for a couple of hours, honestly.
Yeah,
I'm fully figuring it out.
Yeah,
I'm fully in the thick of it. Like, I believe I've set up whatever the end game is.
Ooh, okay.
I'll say this: three things appeared on my map.
Okay, yes, I've done that. That cutscene's great. That whole sequence where they get added is really good.
Yeah. I don't know. Like, maybe that's not true, but it feels like, based on what I have to do, roughly based on what other people talk about how long the game took them, I was like, oh, okay, like, once I do all this and then do all that stuff, I can see where, like, the next, like, 12 hours are in this game.
Right.
And how I reach, I don't know how the DLC intersects, blah, blah, blah. Anyway, I tweeted this weekend, because there's something kind of dawned upon me as I've been playing it. Like, there are games you play and you like them, and sometimes, like, the true appreciation you have for a game happens later, like, you know, either through discussion or reflection.
Yeah.
But it's, like, it's, like, very rare to play a game that, like, in the middle of playing it, like, you realize both how special it is and, like, where it fits, like, in a larger sense of what you appreciate about video games. Like, I'm playing Hollow Knight, and, like, I feel super confident saying it's already one of my favorite games that, like, I've ever played. Like, I don't know where it's going to go the rest of the way, but, like, I felt that way playing Spelunky. I felt that way playing Dark Souls. I felt that way playing Bloodborne. I think I'd actually kick Dark Souls off my top 10 at this point and would put Bloodborne in exchange. I think they're both great games. I think Bloodborne just kind of scratched an itch slightly differently. But, like, I like Metroid-style games, and this is, like, absolutely an all-time great, like, a game that is in concert and conversation with a Super Metroid, and is one of, like, I feel that confident playing it, and it feels special to realize that before you get to the end, where you can, like, just I appreciate it more knowing how much I already enjoy it, and it's been, yeah, I'm so excited to play more of this game, and I'm glad that, like, if there's hours beyond just the main story, there's, like, so much more I can get at, but yeah, like, the thing that you mentioned that I don't want to spoil, about, like, the fact that a whole button on the controller doesn't do anything,
yeah,
and then they add that, I don't want to, like, overstate what that does to the game,
sure.
But it's both a small and big addition in a way that,
it's very cool.
That's the moment when it clicked for me, and I was like, oh, okay, I don't just like this game, and I don't just love this game. Like, it is an all-time great one of these games,
yeah.
Because this is what, like, this is what a game like that does. This is what a game that is that special and that smart, it does something like this, and it does stuff like that all the goddamn time. And furthermore, the other thing is, I'm just constantly shocked at how much this game does not give a shit whether you run into things. Like,
at all.
There are so many, like, even when you play, like, a Super Metroid, or any other of, like, the best of this style of game, you will always run into all the big sort of, like, weapon unlocks and, like, ability. Like, there is a core sort of, like, thing you're supposed to, like, progression that you're going to go along as a character. And usually the things that run along the periphery are, like, oh, like, extra health upgrades and weapon upgrades. Like that stuff is optional and is rewarded by explanation. There are core parts of things you can do as a character the game is perfectly happy with you never ever finding. The NPC that lets you upgrade your, like, main weapon that they call the nail, the game does not, like, put you on a critical path to find him.
No.
When I was googling about how the upgrading system works in the game, I did find him and then realized, like, what material I need in order to upgrade. There was a Reddit thread where someone was like, yo, I'm 35 hours in this game, got to the final boss, and just now stumbled upon the NPC that lets me do weapon upgrades. What the fuck, Hollow Knight?
Yeah, it'd be very easy to miss that character if you were not listening very closely to some NPC dialogue and stuff like that.
That or just stumbled upon it. Like,
yeah,
so much
totally.
Happens with just you. There are, like, major things I have found that is just because I swung my nail and, like, hit a wall that cracked.
Right.
And then I hit it two more times, it opens, and then I find something very vital and important, or it seems vital and important to my playthrough, right? Like,
right.
This is part of what's brilliant about Hollow Knight, is that it has a critical path in a sense, but your way along that, like, if the critical path is a straight line, like the way you actually crisscross through that critical path is up and down like a graph, and every player is going to do that differently.
Uh-huh.
And the confidence this game has to say, we're just going to let you, not hope you'll figure it out, but just, this is the world, and go forth. Like, it just has a confidence that, like, so, not even this style of game, just so few games have, where, like, games are so afraid you're going to miss things. And Hollow Knight goes in the other direction and says, like, actually, we expect you're going to miss most things.
Yeah.
And that's okay. And just, it's just the first game from a team. I cannot imagine what they do from here. And just fucking Hollow Knight. What a game. What a game.
There are also things that you can meet that are just, like, NPCs who, as far as I can tell, maybe have nothing to add except, like, a little tiny brief bit of dialogue and kind of world-building stuff. I know some of them aren't that much, where it's, like, there's, like, that really tall bug whose head sticks up from one screen to another one, and the one's in the stag whatever.
Yeah, the one that's eating food.
Yes, yes. But there's one,
and then you find out something interesting about that creature if you get a certain ability later.
Oh, I've not gone back. I should go back. That's interesting.
You should go back.
The one who I love is, there is a character named Emilisha or something like that, who is she's just a character who's, like, sitting in a room laughing to herself. in the City of Tears. I don't know if you found her, Patrick. And she's just like, she just seems kind of like disconnected from everything terrible outside. You're like, oh, poor creature. Oh, you know, she's it's such a sad story. She's stuck here in all this ruin and she has no idea what's going on here. But you actually get an ability, again, without going into too much detail of how it works, that can give you extra perspective on like what the characters are really up to. And it's just this very dark turn with that character where you're like, oh shit, she is like completely of sound mind and totally understands that everything is terrible and just believes she's on the right side of it all and will like live out anything bad in this area. She'll live through it and come out the other side looking clean and pretty. And it's just like, oh, that's such a good use of Ivanka? Being able to shine some, huh?
Nothing.
I didn't hear what you said.
Very Ivanka Trump.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Yes.
Good.
It's extremely good. Like those little bits, and you could just miss that. Like that's not essential for understanding where to go or what to do, but it's very good at coloring the world a little bit.
And as someone that is never really engaged in the lore and story side of Souls, I actually found it. I have always found it like obtuse to the point of like annoyance.
Right.
It didn't grab me in that way. Like. It was just a little too disconnected, and I didn't want to go watch lore videos. Where people would describe to me the story of those games, they'd be like, "Oh, that sounds very interesting." I didn't get any of that from playing it.
Sincere.
It was like, and it's theoretically interesting, I guess. But like part of my disconnect from it as a player, I guess, feeds into my disinterest in engaging with it, like outside of the game itself. I think Hollow Knight, tells a Soulsian story in a certain sense, but it is a lot easier and more manageable to engage with without being like, here's a cutscene that explains everything that's happening. Like it's far more in the middle, I guess, where it's like, it's not spelling everything out. It's not giving you all the information, but if you want to like play along, like if you want to like be poking and prodding and putting together larger sort of like pieces of the lore and the world building, it's, I guess, more accessible. It is more accessible without being spoon-fed.
Yes.
And so I'm actually finding myself enjoying and entertaining and theorizing in a way that I never did with the Souls games. I found Bloodborne be much more approachable. Like, I guess Dark Souls 1, the Souls game specifically, I always found sort of obtuse in a way that I just never quite got onto. Maybe it's the Lovecraftian stuff in Bloodborne that maybe I just
gave
had a better foundation for it.
Yeah.
But yeah.
They show a lot of it's very clear that early on in that process they were like, we need to tell a more straightforward consumable story than the Souls games do, but we need to retain some very key pillars on how that story is told, as not to dumb it down. They did a good job of that, so shout outs to that team. All right, let's hit the question bucket real quick. Does that sound good?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Let's hit that question.
Love to hit the questions and the question buckets. First question today. If you have a question, of course, you can send it to gaming@vice.com. The first question comes in from Roz, who says, as someone who had waited till adulthood to get into gaming, I've been determined to try a bit of everything and catch up on the last 30-plus years of history that I missed. It's been frustrating to admit that I just don't have the patience for some types of games, Zelda, unfortunately, being a big offender. I love the lore and the characters, and I played the first few hours of almost every game, but the only one I could stick with was Breath of the Wild, thanks to the bite-sized, mostly optional shrines. I know 10-year-old me would have loved the exploration, puzzle solving, and trial and error that define games like Majora's Mask, and I regret that I couldn't have played it when I had the tenacity to match. Do y'all have any games that you think you would have enjoyed better if you could have played them at a different time in your life? Some nodding happening here.
JRPGs.
Yeah, is that what it is for you, Danielle?
Primarily. Something like Persona, I remember watching somebody play all through Persona 5, and I was like, that looks cool. I do not have the patience on earth to kind of sit there and go through all the motions. And just like you were talking about earlier, Austin and Patrick, about sort of having the time to play something. The fact that it's on Switch makes it a lot easier, obviously, to actually sort of go through and play stuff. And I've really loved a lot of JRPGs, primarily on portable systems. I've really liked all the SMT games that I've played on the 3DS, for example. And I've really liked, you know, Chrono Trigger back in the day, and the fact that it was, you know, later on came out on the DS really helped as well. But yeah, For me, it's a lot of just really long games that have a lot of grinding in them. It's hard to make that make sense in a busy life, for sure.
Totally.
I mean, like, so many older games in themselves were these expressions of luxurious amounts of leisure. Like, yeah. Somebody sent me a few years ago a bunch of old, like, Avalon Hill War games. Like, the old ones. So, like, Third Reich, Fall of France, stuff like that. Things that, like, will consume a dining room table. Mm-hmm. But they're all, like, die-cut counters. And so, like... you know, imagine like a half inch counter, you know, a game that's the scale it operates on. It consumes your entire like table and is meant to be played over a period of like weeks. And that was an ethos back in the day. And it wasn't just like it wasn't just like sort of, you know, that was sort of the state of the art at the time. But there was also kind of an ethos about like why they made choices to simulate things that way. You know, you'd have pages and pages of like self-justifying designer's notes. Early PC war games were the same way. And I look at these things and I talk to friends who like, you know, played games like that. And I ferociously envy them having been contemporaries of games like that, where you could find games like that, like people who played them and experience them as they're meant to be. Because on my bookshelf, they're objets d'art, right? Like it's a thing that like I can see how it worked, but right. It's an artifact of like a dead civilization in some ways. And you can't go back. Like I can talk to like, you know, I'm gonna see him later this week, but my buddy from Three Moves Ahead, Bruce Garrick, he played all this shit. Well, I'd have to hold a gun on him to get him to play these games again. Like the moment has passed, the art has moved on, but there was something of merit there. It's just it passed.
Yeah, that's how I feel about a lot of tabletop role-playing games that are super crunchy in the same way. There's an RPG coming out that's in playtest now, a tabletop RPG called Lancer, which is like a mecha, like it's like a BattleTech RPG, right? I mean, there is actually a BattleTech RPG, but Lancer is very similar to that, and it's like one of the crunchiest. It's not one of the crunchiest. It is a very crunchy game, which is to say, for people who don't know that terminology, it means it's very rules heavy. It means there's lots of little tiny moving parts and variables. It means that like there are special rules for doing lots of different types of attacks in combat, for different types of movement and momentum. It's like the difference between like The Sims, which is, you know, The Sims has a lot of rules in it, but Dwarf Fortress has way more rules. Dwarf Fortress is much crunchier as a game than The Sims is. And I'm at the point now where in my tabletop RPG days or time, I want more of The Sims and less of Dwarf Fortress. Or I want something that can produce the sorts of stories that something like Dwarf Fortress produces without the crunchiness, right? And that's kind of a bummer in some ways, because that is a function partially of time, but it's also a function of taste changing. Like, I played Shadowrun in college. I played Cyberpunk 2020 in college. I don't know that those games would be to my taste today. They're just not, in terms of as the games are designed, not built that way. And that can be a bummer.
I mean, a game I think about a lot is, like, I played enough of the original XCOM to, like, get why people fell in love with it.
Yes.
And, like, there's a lot to love about the new XCOM 1, XCOM 2. There's a lot of great stuff there. There's aspects of that original experience that are simply not translated to the new generation. Like the entire feeling of like the squads, I think, were like 15 squad members in the original game, and that meant a lot of them were expendable. And so you have this feeling of sending, it was very Aliens-esque, where like some of these troopers were just out there to draw fire and go get murdered in the darkness of the map. And that's incredibly evocative and intense when it happens. And it's a cool moment. But to get that moment, you're playing this really fussy, wide-ranging, endless tactical game that, like, I'll make my compromise. I'll give up that moment so I can just play the fucking mission in a session with Austin, you know, in an hour. Yeah. Like, that's the choice I'll make.
Totally. Yeah, we could not do Tactical Tuesdays with original XCOM. It would not be – you couldn't fit into the schedule. We just couldn't. We'd also, all my misclicks would get us completely wiped out.
Oh my god, I'd have murdered you by now.
I mean, that builds something else though, which is funny, which is, you talk about playing XCOM with me. The other thing for me here is co-op games. I look at something like Deep Rock Galactic, which I think has a fucking cool ass style, and the pitch on it, which is like, what if instead of being, it's like Left 4 Dead, but you're a bunch of dwarves, like sci-fi space dwarves, digging through caverns, to like destructible caverns, to looking for minerals and like using cool traversal abilities to get across, you know, chasms. And one of you has a grapple gun to set up cool things, and one of you has a jetpack. Like, it looks dope. It looks so cool. And also, that's not how I play games anymore. Like, that's part of why PUBG was such an exception for my life last year, was like, I don't spend my nighttime, my free time, playing games with other people anymore. I like the quiet games at night that I can play by myself, or like while, you know, hanging out with somebody else, or on a call with somebody else, or while watching something. And like, they have to be almost like, that's why, like, the rise of podcast games, so to speak, has been so big for me, because, like, that's what the bulk of my non-work game playing is like. Whereas 10 years ago, like, 5 years ago, even in the age of Borderlands 2, in the age of Left 4 Dead 1 and 2, like, I would have eaten up a game like Deep Rock Galactic. I would have eaten up a game like, what's the co-op RPG? The second one came out, and it's now out on consoles. It's coming out on consoles. Divinity: Original Sin 2 is like something that, like, 10 years ago, I would have played that through multiple times with different people, because that's what my gaming habits were like. And I wish those games had been out then, instead of it just being me playing Left 4 Dead over and over and over and over and over again with the same three people. You know, so those are it for me. Patrick, can I guess JRPG again, or do you have something else in mind here?
Well, I mean, that's true, but like, I know what JRPGs are, and so, like, for me, it's actually like, it's board games. Like, I don't have the like I have a framework for, like, even if I do find, like, Octopath, like, I have a framework for what that game is. I can jump into it. I can you know, quickly start playing it and enjoying it for what it is. Like, I don't really play board games. I don't have a framework for board games. I didn't grow up playing board games, but like, so the mental financial hurdle to getting into board games is such that, like, you know, I don't have the time for it. I'm like worried that, if, like, okay, if I'm going to go into this one, maybe I don't like this one.
Say, you don't, like, know what you like at all. It's so, you're right. Totally dead on. Like, there's so much work that needs to be done whenever you enter a new genre or medium or anything. We're like, hey, what the fuck do I like? What is out there to begin with?
And then it's, you know, furthermore, like, you know, I know the amount of time it takes to even just get into a place to start playing a game. And so the idea of, like, oh, I'm going to spend like $150 on a board game. I'm going to have to put aside a day to learn how it works. And then what if I find out that I don't enjoy it? It's just like, I don't know that with absent someone that could be like your board game spirit guy, that's like, I already own all this stuff. Tell me what kind of things you like, you know, like someone that could, like, funnel me there and, like, hold my hand. Like, without that, it's just no world for me to do it, because I just do not have the time to invest to figure that out. And, like, apps and all that other stuff, like, I don't know how that changes, right? Like, that there's just, it's just really difficult to imagine that, because I don't have
to your Dante.
I need both, the someone that was able to be like a guide would help me be able to, like, jump over some of the time hoops, right? Like, so it's like, it's not just me and my wife sitting down figuring out, okay, none of our other friends played board games, but if we asked people to come over and, like, do something for a night, they would. But it's like, so we need to figure out which is the one, you know what I mean? Like, good. There's just so many hurdles to getting there that, like, I could scrape out the time part if I knew that I could get right to the heart of it really quickly with someone that's like, I'm pretty sure this is what, like, this, or this is a good entry, you know what I mean? Like, that sort of thing could at least get me there. But, you know, I don't have that stuff. I can't imagine a world where that changes. Excited because my kid's about to turn 2, which means our lives are going to start becoming less antisocial. Mm-hmm. Because once they're 2, you can sign them up for classes, which means you meet other parents that have the same age kid as you, which means you end up doing, like, things with other parents again.
Right.
So maybe I'll get lucky and I'll run into someone that, you know, is into board games or wants to learn board games. And then it's like, okay, our kids are going to hang out together. Like, we can, you know, start carving out that time and figuring it out. But I don't think that's going to
change. See, insufferable as I am, I'm like, Oh, I got recommendations. I can get Patrick set up and on his way, like, right the fuck now. And, like, I'm going to shoot some emails your way. I'm going to make some introductions real quick. Don't worry about it.
Yeah. I mean, the thing is, the thing that you need, or in my experience, as both a board game learner and a board game teacher, I want to be in the room with someone and see how they react to something. Because as a learner, I often didn't know what I liked and didn't like, even as I was liking it and didn't and not liking it. Like, even as I played a game, I would sometimes be like, I just don't like how it's so random. And, like, what's that mean, actually, Austin? Like, there's dice and randomness in most games. What is the thing that feels – dig into that a little bit. And I was grateful that I had more, wise and storied tabletop board game players who could be like, okay, the thing that you're actually talking about isn't randomness. It's that – the outcomes are hidden from you, that you don't know what potential outcomes could be. You're cool over here when there's randomness, but you can see what the 6 or 20 possible outcomes are. And like that, by bit, it drilled me down to know that I like these types of board games. I have a high tolerance for ridiculous Ameritrash high theme board games, and also can respect, but maybe don't want to play a lot of the kind of like super crisp Euro games where everything is abstracted into little chits and like you just kind of move tiles around and call them samurai, you know. It's fun. It has been fun to learn.
Sounded board like games you were talking way. Shit about Sekigahara.
Listen, I'm just saying that, no, I'm not talking shit about Sekigahara. Sekigahara is totally fine. But I was talking shit to that style of, or I'm talking shit about like worker management games, that aren't themed particularly strongly. I like theming. Like I like, that's one of the reasons I wish Patrick, I would love for you to get into board games. I like everybody who likes video games should. It's hard. You're not wrong. But I think we'd all be better as game critics and game, you know, players and people in the marketplace of game ideas if we all had the shared language of board games, because one, board games can teach you how to like mechanics for the sake of mechanics in a way that most AAA games aren't necessarily that good at, like showing you that you like that stuff.
Well, they hide it. It's obfuscated, yes. Under, you know, graphics,
yep.
And all sorts of other things.
100%. And every now and then something breaks through, but even then it's hard. Whereas board games is like, that's their fucking bread and butter. Or you could be like me and learn that actually you do want graphics. And sometimes in the case of board games, what graphics means is a giant fucking bullshit map and a bunch of different card decks to look through. And I really like the Android board game. It's terrible. It's terrible, but look it up.
So that's
it's very
like
fun.
Android Netrunner?
Yeah, the Android Netrunner like universe was born in this board game that Fantasy
oh, so
Flight
is
made.
Is that why the license
Android.
ends up
yes.
expiring?
Well, no. So they have the license for Android forever. Fantasy Flight owns Android. That's their setting. What they don't have the license for anymore is Netrunner, the card game that was originally made by Richard Garfield for Wizards of the Coast, which, and I'm gonna cyberbrain, you know, like galaxy brain, but I'm gonna cyberbrain really quick. So that reverted. So this was in the news. We didn't talk about it on the podcast. Android Netrunner is going out of print very shortly.
Which is weird, because this is a game that appears to be at its, like, zenith, right?
Peak.
Like, they just did
yes,
a reissue
totally.
Of the starter set. Like,
yes, they just
it
reissued
is a massively
the starter
popular
set.
Competitive game.
And, yes, it's, again, massively popular competitive game, huge scene, fantastic scene, great game. One of my favorite games, period. And for whatever reason, Fantasy Flight was unable or didn't re-up the license. They had to license that game from Wizards of the Coast. And here is my cyberbrain conspiracy theory. They got outbid by CD Projekt Red.
Oh.
This is complete conjecture. Complete conjecture.
Cyberbrain.
Cyberbrain Austin Walker.
Why would they want it?
Netrunner was originally set in the Cyberpunk universe, the Cyberpunk 2020
it's gonna
universe.
It's going to be their Gwent
game. They're going to put it into Cyberpunk 2077, and then they're going to release a standalone Netrunner game, but with new cards, or like new their version of that game, basically. But yes, it's going to be their Gwent.
They just did a physical version of Gwent,
They did
right?
just do a physical version of Gwent. Rob has turned away from the camera and is looking at the wall. I'm tapping my head three times. This is my future prediction. I have no insider information on this.
Couldn't they have just done what they did with Gwent and just reskin Netrunner? Like,
no, because Condottiere, what was it? Condottiere, yeah, is that the board or whatever? Those people don't have any money. Fantasy Flight does. Fantasy Flight would have figured out how to sue them, and so they're just going to do it the right way, which is license the game. It just fucks over. This, who knows? I could be completely wrong. I'm probably completely
but
wrong.
But it is a fascinating conjecture. Also, I'm going to crack up if Cyberpunk, with the tone we saw of that game, does the thing they did with Gwent, where, like, for whatever reason, in this, like, really gritty, grim, depressing-ass world, people are like, hey, you want to play a game of Netrunner?
You want to play some Netrunner?
As long as we're...
It's somebody who's, you know, dying, and the trauma center has been called on them to get out whatever, you know, chip in their head.
While we wait.
In my last seconds.
Want to play some... I have rare cards. God.
You only have 10 minutes because I only have 10 minutes.
Totally. God. They could do worse for hacking rules is the other thing I'll say. That game is cool, and they could do some cool stuff adapting some of those rules just directly into the hacking minigames. Anyway, that's my ridiculous theory. All right. You want to call it there? You want to do some waypoints and get out of here?
Yeah.
Sure.
All right. Who has a waypoint?
I got a waypoint.
Hell yeah.
You want to know what's a good game?
What's a good game?
Sonic Mania.
Oh, right.
It just got reissued as well. I should probably say I played a whole bunch of it, but not the reissue. I just randomly was like, you know what's a good game? I was just playing with my friends the other night. It's Sonic Mania. So I will be playing the reissue, and I'm sure I'll have like a word or two about the new stuff. But it's just a really good platformer from a year ago. It's just awesome. A really good, really well-designed. Gotta go fast. Sonic was good for a whole, 3 months.
You do right gotta there. Go fast. You're not wrong. You're not wrong. Robert Patrick, give me a waypoint. Hit me with that waypoint.
Sure. Yeah, I watched this great movie over the weekend called The Endless. It's from this directing duo that has done a lot of interesting sort of horror, paranoia, thriller work, and their newest one is about... try to talk about it as vaguely as possible. It's about a UFO death cult.
Great.
There's this older brother, much younger brother. They have maybe like 10, 12 years in age difference. Something happened to their parents. They somehow get roped into this UFO death cult. Eventually the older brother sort of like breaks the brainwash, and they run away from the cult. They go off on their own for like a decade or more. They're not doing particularly well, like away from the cult. Like they are kind of barely scraping by. The younger brother's like whole interpretation of what happened is like very positive and fuzzy and warm because he was a kid at the time. And then they get a tape in the mail that's sort of like all the people they were with like saying goodbye. It's a tape that is marked as like the day that they're in now, but they all look as though they haven't aged a day. And so the younger brother is having trouble getting closure over what happened because he, again, like looks back on what happened as like something warm and wonderful and was the closest thing they had to family. And so the older brother wonders if he'll finally indulge the younger brother, and they go back to the UFO death cult just to like visit the sort of like kind of like encampment that they have. And if for a day or two, if he sees what it's like, maybe he'll realize like, you know, that it's finally time to move on. And lots of stuff happens, when they get there. It's a very, I guess the Lovecraft would be the sort of like tonal, sort of like part of the story. It's really fun and enjoyable and weird. And has some actual like interesting hooks to previous films that the duo has worked on, if you care about that sort of thing. So it's called The Endless.
Nice.
Rad. I went to Game Devs of Color this past weekend, which was it's a convention that's held pretty much every year here in New York that brings together a lot of game developers of color, people of color who make games. There were a ton of great talks there and a ton of great games there. I'm still catching up on the talks. I didn't get there till late, so I've been watching some of the archived video of the ones that I'd missed. But the games there were incredible. It was like 25 games on display there. I just want to shout out a couple of them really quickly. I mean, there's a page you can go to that's just at gamedevsofcolorexpo.com, and you just click on games, you'll see all of that stuff. There were a bunch that I liked. There's like a couple visual novels I really liked. One called The Last Stop, that did some really cool things with like different types of language, about, I believe a Thai kid or a Thai family, and like this kid who kind of like gets on the subway and winds up going to this weird, almost, magical realist, like final stop on the train, that's out on this strange island. But it does really cool stuff with language, blending Thai and Chinese, language. That kind of represents this multicultural background. It does the pyre mouse over thing where you can mouse over and learn what what the word means and what its origin is. And it has a really cool style. A game called Solace State, Solace State, STATE, which is a visual novel about a near future, surveillance state that builds some of the visual, put some of the words in the world. It has kind of sometimes in movies, the subtitles will appear like on the side of a building or on a street sign or something like that.
Diegetic,
like,
semi.
Yes, like or, semi-diegetic. Yeah. So that does that sometimes. And that's a really cool look. But then I'd say like the ones that made maybe the big, oh, one more small one is Becker Derby, BECKER Derby, which is I guess Disclosure, made by a fan, Rajan, I want to say Taylor, Rajan Taylor Foster, which is one of those things that's like, okay, Becker College decided they wanted a game, or maybe Rajan pitched this. This is going to sound like a pun in a second. You are a batter who is like batting against this bird pitcher. It's an iOS and Android game, and it's like an arcadey baseball game, and it has the best feel. Like, it just has such a good, like, not mouse feel, but like touch feel of hitting the ball, the kinetic feeling of knocking the ball out. But the two I actually want to super, super, super shout out, because I think that they're going to be, one of them I think is going to be genuinely big. And the other one is just looks and feels great. There's a game called Zarvot, Zarvot, which is...
Zarvot.
You got it. Zarvot. It's like competitive game in which you are all playing as cubes. It has kind of a tilt shifted, isometric perspective, and it's four people playing as cubes who are either doing like, King of the Hill style control for part of the map. It reminds me of something like Gang Beasts, in terms of its visual style. But, you know, you either shoot a big laser beam or shoot a bunch of little shots or grow strange, like saw blades out of your side or do a big AoE smash. And it's like this cool couch competitive, abstract arcade game. Like, I would love to sit down with people and play this who are people I knew. It would be very much one of those games that would start you screaming. And the other one I think has maybe the best, the other game, last game I'll suggest that I saw there, that I think maybe it has the best two-word pitch I can ever come up with, which is, Tetris Tactics. It's called Omino, O-M-I-N-O. So let me pitch it to you this way. It is it's a Tetris RTS. You get Tetris you and your opponent have bases. And the goal is to build a bridge or a line from Tetris pieces from your base to their base. Starts out pretty simple. In the tutorial, it's like, all right, try to build in a way that blocks your opponent from getting to you, but you can get to them. But then bit by bit, it adds extra stuff. So like eventually you get to where you're building up over time a hammer resource that can break through their pieces. When you place your piece, you can break down their line. And anything that's no longer connected to their home base is no longer actually like viable for them. They have to reconnect it. And then it tells you, oh, well, do you want to place more pieces more quickly so you don't have to wait for this energy timer? Do you want to have more pieces in your kind of hand of Tetris pieces more quickly? Well, then start building out certain shapes, and then you're effectively building RTS style buildings. So, if you build like a 4x4 vertical, box, then that, or a rectangle, that gives you more energy more quickly. Oh, if you build this kind of diagonal shape, that'll give you more Tetris pieces more quickly. Oh, if you build this other shape, it's like a barracks, and it will give you the hammers to break through stuff more quickly. And if that's not enough, then they start adding, like, buildings already on the map that if you can connect to them, you start getting a bonus. So for one, I got stuck on this level for a long time until I realized that one of the buildings would give all of my Tetris pieces an additional block. So it would be an L block, but instead of being three high, it would be four high. Or it would be one of those T blocks, but it would have an extra block on the front of the T, or like the lower end of the T. And that stuff is just, it's immediately you see this game and you're like, oh shit, this is a thing. Like, oh, this is conceptually super a thing already. And it's a really cool looking game. It's called Omino, O-M-I-N-O. And it's I think it's part of the NYU Game Center incubation chamber. That's not what it's called. It's not called the incubation chamber. Incubator, I think. Yes, the 2018 incubator. So check that out. O-M-I-N-O. I think Danielle is writing down all of these so that they will be in the show notes.
Sounds amazing. Also because it sounds amazing.
Yes.
I always write them down.
That sounds
I wrote
really
that
good.
One down excitedly.
It's really fucking cool. I'll link you to a trailer, everybody in this call.
Nice.
So that is my waypoint for the week. And also just like, it was cool to go see people who were excited about their games. Like, it is too often that this job gets so focused on the, like, I'm in meetings all day, or we're in a dry period for us, and it's like, oh well, we know traffic isn't going to be the same this week as this month as last month was June, and this month it's like kind of a dry July, and oh, we got to find new angles and blah blah blah. But you know, then you get to go to an event like this, and I sat down and played a co-op game called Neon Krieger Yamato, which is, again, what a good fucking name. That was like a co-op, like, anime 8-bit style NES game, and like, you know, high-fiving this complete stranger because we were beating the boss and like figuring out how the mechanics worked. And that stuff is just like, yes, and meeting developers who are so excited to be there, so excited to show their work, re-energized me a lot. Maybe that's why it felt like a holiday Monday to me for some reason, you know?
Good games time.
All right. That is my waypoint. Rob, do you have a waypoint?
Yeah. So a few nights ago, I ended up, watching what I think has quietly turned into one of my favorite movies, which is, Margin Call. And it was my first time watching it in the new place, which is it's a film that takes place basically in the night before the start of the 2008 financial crisis.
Oh, this is one of the HBO movies, right?
I don't think so. I think this was a major studio picture. Zachary Quinto, Stanley Tucci, Paul Bettany, fortunately Kevin Spacey, and Jeremy Irons is in it as well. As well as Demi Moore. Basically, like, The Mentalist is in it. Austin?
Here. Yes.
But
Patrick Mentalist.
Yeah, Patrick Mentalist.
Patrick Jane. No, that's the name of the character. Simon Baker.
Yeah. It's a really, like, as you might guess, it's just a movie with a lot of really tremendous performances. And basically, the start of the movie is like, if you remember it, like, 2008 was when the crisis really, like, peaked, but even as far back as, like, 2007, even as a layman, you could tell, like, something was off about, like, the economy. Like, just, I don't know, there's a weird vibe already around business and finance in 2007. This takes place basically, like, the night before a major, like, investment bank, when they realize what has gone wrong with mortgage-backed securities. And when they realize that this entire system is basically teetering and that all these banks are holding massive bundles of toxic assets on their books while they sort of layer them together into larger like tranches of debt. But you don't need it's not like The Big Short, which is really kind of a primer on how it all went wrong. This is really more of a like a crime movie in a lot of ways. This is the night everyone realizes the game is about to be up. They have 24 hours to figure out what they're going to do before the shit hits the fan. So, like, who are they? What are they really about? What is their philosophy about business and their role in society when, like, the rubber meets the road? And so it's the series, this long night, as these bankers sort of like first come to grips with the enormity of what they've done and what is about to happen. And then when they begin like deciding on a course of action. And it's just really a series of like scenes between two and three characters as they sort of interrogate their role in society, the things they've told themselves to get to this point and to justify to themselves why they have so much money, and then how this is going to like how this changes things, right? And there are people who are absolute cynics in this entire thing who kind of take the attitude that you know, finance has always been a rigged game. Like, we've always known that, so who the hell is anyone else to complain, right? It's a little late to, you know, plead innocence because you're about to, like, torch a lot of people who don't deserve it. That's what this has always been about. And then there are a lot of, like, old school, you know, business-type people who always thought, like, it was about giving a fair deal to your colleagues, right? It was about doing business as honestly and ethically as possible. And what happens to those people when they're faced with like, here's the day when you have to go out and sell something, you know, is shit when you know, you are going to be actively harming, not just your peers, but like society at large. And it is just a like utterly haunting and riveting movie. All the characters are incredibly, well written. Paul Bettany it's one of his best performances. And it's a movie that like once, like I popped it in basically just to test the audio, sync on my DVD player.
That's how it always goes.
Yeah. And then I was like, I'm just watching this thing. Here it goes. And, it's tremendous. And I highly recommend if they never did see it or haven't seen it in a while, give it another shot.
I just need you to know the absurdity of like, I'm just going to put in one of my favorite movies to, test the audio sync on my new DVD player. You knew what this was.
Yeah.
the guy who regularly goes back and plays games from 15 years ago just, oops, I'm just going to put in this classic film. A Rob's Rob movie.
Uh-huh.
See what happens.
Yeah. God. All right. On that note, before we go, just two pieces of quick bookkeeping. One, if you hear this tonight, the night that this goes live, you will have approximately, I'll say 12, 13, 14 hours to send over questions about Riverdale, the television show Riverdale. Because we are going to do a brief Waypoint 101 tomorrow morning with a special guest about Riverdale. So send in your Riverdale questions to gaming@vice.com, subject Riverdale.
We got Archie.
We got Archie. I don't want Archie. Archie's the maybe the worst person from that show. We'll talk. I'll dig into that tomorrow, I guess. There's a lot. So that's one. So for people who've been itching for a Waypoint 101, watch all that show by tomorrow morning or else. Two, there is also a real Waypoint 101 coming. Not that this isn't a real Waypoint 101, but, you know, a game one that will play over the course of the next month or so. Probably a little bit over that.
There's some shade in that. Austin.
Yeah, the shade is that we're telling people we're going to do a Riverdale Waypoint 101 less than 24 hours before we do it. That is all the shade.
That's true.
Also, the shade
I'm just saying, our longest Waypoint 101 was a movie. So,
right. You know. Fair. Yeah. So we're going to go try. Last time, Mad Max, we were like, however long it takes. This time, we're like, no, watch all of Riverdale between now and 9 a.m. Do it.
Go on.
That'll come out sometime.
If this show is of interest to you, you already know.
Probably.
You're probably in on it.
I didn't know until y'all lit my life up with some Riverdale.
No, until you were bored on a plane. Let's be honest. Like, we told you for months, and you were finally, like, trapped.
Yeah, that's accurate. But then I liked it a lot, and I kept watching it. So, you know, that's it. Sometimes you gotta be trapped on a plane. Our next video game, Waypoint 101... for presumably probably July and August, we'll probably record this sometime in mid to late August, is Shadowrun Dragonfall. I believe the director's cut is the one that's available on Steam. It is I've never played the director's cut, but the original is a really great cyberpunk game. It's a cyberpunk tactical RPG with some really incredible writing. The pitch, I think the pitch that finally I was trying to give a soft pitch for this game that turned very quickly into a hard pitch when I started describing the setting, which is cyberpunk Germany that has turned into a stable anarchy known as the Flux State. If you want there to be, like, hackers who are investigating the death of a dragon, if you want there to be, like, what if a guy who used to be a punk rocker is now worships like a dragon deity, and also his nephew gets into trouble by teaming up with some fascist human supremacists, and he has to go, like, fucking fix his nephew's whole worldview. If you want, like, a cool lady with badass robot cyber arms who has a really interesting backstory, you should check out Shadowrun Dragonfall as we play through it for our next Waypoint 101.
Real quick, Austin.
There will be a thread.
Yeah. Just as people hover on that store page, there's also a compilation bundle for $55. Worth it if someone's kind of on the fence, like, do I just want to just go all the way in? Or is this the one you recommend unreservedly?
I recommend Dragonfall. I didn't finish Hong Kong, so I can't give it the, like, complete... Hong Kong seems dope. Hong Kong seems really good. Returns is, like, okay. They didn't... with all the years removed from Shadowrun Returns at this point, I can kind of firmly say that anything it does well, Dragonfall and Hong Kong do better. Returns is a very linear game in terms of feel and in terms of actual, it is a linear game. Dragonfall and Hong Kong both give you that feeling of building out a team of Shadowrunners who all have different interesting backstories, whereas Returns is very much more like, I mean, there are other runners that you can work with in Returns, but you don't get that same good feeling of, like, this is my crew. We all have our own issues that we all are all helping each other with. So I would say start with Dragonfall, and if you like Dragonfall a lot, go forward to Hong Kong. And I guess if you're, like, a true diehard after that, maybe go back and play through Returns. But Dragonfall and Hong Kong are definitely the two that I can fully recommend, or that I really recommend. And Dragonfall is the one that we're gonna do for a 101. So I think it's like $15 right now. Someone's honking because they want to play Dragonfall,
and they want to know where to send their questions.
And that is game. I'm telling you, you can stop honking now.
The people have spoken. Where do you send the questions?
Gaming@vice.com. You Shadowrun and question or Waypoint 101 Shadowrun or something. We'll dig those up once it's time to do this again. We won't be doing the episode for another 6 weeks, probably 4 to 6 weeks. As before, we're just kind of saying, you know, play the first 10 hours of this game. It's like a 20-hour game, all said. If you want to play through the whole thing, play through the whole thing. I will probably use this opportunity to play through the whole thing. But if you don't, you don't have to. It's okay. Just play enough so that we can talk about what's going on in this game and why are there elves and also robots. And I'm going to always say, why not? You know, I think William Gibson maybe got this one wrong. He hates Shadowrun, like, a lot, so that's an interesting thing. Anyway, there will be a thread up on the forum, and there will be a chat room in the over on the Discord. So check those out if you want to participate. And as always, you can feel free to just tweet at me and be like, yo, you're right, this game was good. Or, no, actually, you know, don't do that second one. How about don't do that second one? If you want to do that second one, you're like, this game's bad, Austin, just write it in a notepad and then close it, and that's okay. Pretend I saw it. That's going to do it for us today. I'm Austin Walker. Follow me on Twitter at Austin_Walker. Where can people find you, Danielle?
At Danielle R.I.
Patrick, how about you?
At Patrick Lupin.
What about you, Rob? Where could people find you and all of your glorious takes and all of your descriptions of the desert sands of Karak?
You can find me at Rob Zachney, but if that sort of thing intrigues you, I guess you could also listen to Three Moves Ahead.
You should probably, yeah, that's actually a good call. Follow everything Waypoint does, twitter.com/waypoint, twitch.tv/waypoint, youtube.com/waypointvice, and facebook.com/waypointvice. We will be back on Wednesday, probably, with our Riverdale 101, and then again on Friday. As always, thank you to Bowen for letting us use the track Miss You off the EP Pale Machine. Find out more about that, waypoint.zone/BOEN. On this very, very hot and humid Monday morning afternoon, Danielle, what do we say to him?
Be good or be good at it!
Peace!
Peace!
There it is.